Resources Committee to order. Today's Friday, February 2nd, 2024, and the time is 3:30 p.m. A reminder to please silence your cell phones. Let me make sure mine is. Yes. Members present today, Senator Dunbar, Senator Kaufman, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski. I am expecting Senator Kawasaki soon, and I am co-chair Senator Giesel. Senator Click Bishop and Matt Clayman are both excused from today's business. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you, Sav and Dylan, for your help with keeping the secretarial records and the LIO audio. We have two things on our agenda today. The first thing will be Senate Bill 118, Critical Natural Resources Reports by Senator Merrick. And the second item will be the first hearing with public testimony on the Executive Order 132, eliminating the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council. So we'll start out with Senate Bill 118. So I want to invite Senator Kelly Merrick and her aide to come forward and present the bill. Let's see, It looks like online is Brent Sheets, Director of the Petroleum Development Lab at UAF also. So that's all I'm seeing up here, but I'm also seeing some other people who probably are just listening in. Oh, thank you. And then there's some invited testimony that we'll get to. All right, so welcome, Senator Merrick, if you'd like to present your bill.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Kelly Merrick, Senator for District L in beautiful Chugiak, Eagle River. Thank you, Chair Giesel and members of the Senate Resources Committee, for the opportunity to present Senate Bill 118, Critical Natural Resources Report. Senate Bill 118 was crafted alongside industry and directs the state to assess critical mineral potential and identify strategies to attract investment. Critical and essential minerals are things like lithium, copper, cobalt, zinc, and more. These minerals are key components of modern technology like the cell phones and microwaves that we use every day. We need to ensure the world can continue to access these resources, and Alaska can play an important role in the supply chain for our nation. Demand will continue to increase as renewable energy development grows. These minerals are needed in emerging technologies like electric vehicles and solar panels, as well as in our national defense systems. Communist China is home to the world market for the extraction and processing of critical minerals. Currently, China dominates globally with 60% of supply and 85% of production. Madam Chair, this is unacceptable. It is crucial that we reduce our reliance on adversarial nations and produce these minerals here at home. This bill has the potential to increase investment in Alaska and strengthen national security. Chair Giesel, my staff, Carrie Crocker, is available for a sectional and to answer questions.
Wonderful. Great. If you could go through a sectional.
For the record, Carrie Crocker, staff to Senator Merrick. Section 1 of the bill adds a new section to uncodified law to produce three reports. One, the Office of the Governor shall generate a plan for exploration, production, refining, and development of critical minerals used in emerging technology. Subsection B, the Department of Natural Resources shall compare Alaska's current and potential critical mineral production to national and international production, including regulation, permitting, and incentives. The report should identify strategies to increase exploration development over the next 3, 5, and 10 years. Subsection C, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development shall identify the state's role in innovation, manufacturing, and transportation to support the global green energy transition.
Very good. Thank you. I see that you have Mr. Sheets on, Director of the Petroleum Development Lab, to do a presentation on the bill as invited testimony.
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right. That would be great. Mr. Sheets is online. Director Sheets, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yes. Welcome. I will let you begin your testimony after you identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Well, thank you. My name is Brent Sheets. I'm the director of the Petroleum Development Lab here in Alaska, University of Alaska Fairbanks. It just occurred to me as we were saying this, I'm going to have to come up with a new name for our lab because we do a lot more than petroleum. And the name of the petroleum program here is going to change to Energy Resources Engineering as we expand beyond petroleum. So I guess I'll have to come back next year and update my testimony. But anyway, our teams engage with the industry to identify and we address challenges hindering private sector investment and resource development projects throughout Alaska, whether those challenges be technical, infrastructure, which is a big challenge, or environmental. Current Petroleum Development Lab projects include developing technology to enable production of, like, the North Slope's vast heavy oil resources. We recently received an award from the Department of Energy for carbon capture, utilization, and sequestration to examine some depleting gas fields in the Cook Inlet area for potential CO2 storage, and even demonstrating small-scale coal plant technology to promote affordable energy necessary to build industrial and manufacturing capacity in our state instead of just sending our ore outside. Finally, I'm also the principal investigator for the DOE-funded Carbon Ore Rare Earth and Critical Minerals Project, and it's in that capacity that I'm here before you today. If you could go to the next slide, please. I should point out that the DGGS is our partner in this DOE-funded endeavor that I'm here to talk to you about, and these next two slides are directly from their work. Alaska's long been a major source for some of the world's most valuable resources. Alaskan geologists have been very active in characterizing the state's mineral resources, and they've been thorough and comprehensive in their efforts within the capabilities of the characterization technology of the day and the budgets available at the time of their specific studies. In many cases, this information includes archiving rare earth elements and critical minerals characterization. Now, for the course of this testimony, I'll use the phrases interchangeable along with strategic minerals. There is a technical difference between them, but for our purposes, I'm going to lump them all together. Even though these past materials that have been reported, rare earth elements, critical minerals, may have had minimal commercial potential at the time of their particular study, at least they were still documented. So our Alaska team, particularly the DGGS, is examining this large body of legacy work and is conducting some preliminary examinations of some of the vast archive of mineral samples that are retained in the Geological Material Center in Anchorage, a world-class sample repository. This work has already yielded some results and has confirmed that Alaska has abundant, untapped critical mineral resources, as you might expect. Rare earth elements can be found at most known mine sites throughout the state, as illustrated in this map, with more discoveries to come. The potential rare earth elements are in red. Ray River is an example of a surprising find brought to light by the DOE-funded CoreCM program here. DGGS reviewed some old reports, leading them to collect samples only several miles up the Ray River near the Yukon River Bridge on the Dalton Highway. And we believe those samples will demonstrate that that area holds some world-class germanium and gallium deposits, which are ripe for someone to lease and which are very much needed in the country right now. In addition, preliminary studies at the Usabelli Coal Mine, also a partner of our CoreCM program, demonstrate some promising seams for economic concentrations of critical minerals within their leases. And we are just in the very early stages of discussing a potential project with them to figure out how to concentrate that material on the site to improve their economics for potentially producing rare earth minerals from that coal mine. Beyond these two examples, the Ray River and Usabelli Coal, we're engaging with several other mines in Alaska, and indications are that they too have high potential for critical mineral resources to be produced along with their main mineral product. The next slide, please. Though vastly underdeveloped and underexplored, Alaska has been and continues to be a producer of rare earth elements and critical minerals. Historic rare earth element production includes antimony, barite, chromium, platinum, and tin. Current production includes zinc and germanium. The Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska is the largest producer of zinc in the world. Germanium is contained in the same ore with the zinc and separated during the smelting process. The company-owned smelter in Canada receives credit for that germanium production, not the Red Dog Mine, and the quantity of germanium produced from Red Dog Mine is unknown. Many critical minerals needed for economic and national security are supplied by countries with adversarial relationships with the United States. And most of the 34 critical minerals shown on this chart are also strategic minerals. And Alaska has the potential to supply many of those commodities. The next slide, please, shows applications for rare earth elements. They're used in metals and alloys and they're found in all of our common consumer goods like computers, our cell phones, catalytic converters found on vehicles, fluorescent and LED lighting, and a whole lot more, as you can see from this chart. Further, rare earth elements play an essential role in modern national defense. Night vision goggles, precision guided weapons, other defense technologies rely on various rare earth metals. Rare earth metals are also the key ingredients for radar systems, avionics, satellites. So I highly encourage us to embrace the entire spectrum of the potential markets for our rare earth elements and critical minerals, and figure out how to get them into the value chain. My point is that it can be used for a whole lot more than renewable energy. The next slide, please. It finally brings me to the mission of our program, the CoreCM program, Carbon Ore, which is another name for coal these days, a rare earth and critical minerals. We view our mission is to help establish a critical minerals industry in the state, not just mine and export it, but actually the entire industry to the extent that we can. This is consistent with DOE's visions, which is to accelerate research that will enable the commercial development of advanced processing and production of rare earth and critical minerals, high-value non-fuel coal products as well throughout the country. DOE is also funding us to support engagement of public-private partnerships. The goal is at the end of our program, we'll be able to be self-funded with private funds, and then to advance new and innovative technology development, as well as the potential for some new product development, and then advance opportunities for education and training of the next generation of technicians, skilled workers, and STEM. So we're kind of looking at the whole chain with our CoreCM program. The next slide, please. So DOE has established 13 CoreCM centers around the country. We're just one of 13. All 13 of these CoreCM centers are currently in phase one, which is on this chart here. All the CoreCM centers have the same funding amount. We all have the same tasks, and I'll get into the tasks next. There will be a down select from 13 centers to 8 centers for phase two, and then again from 8 centers to 5 centers for phase three. So you can see how competitive this is going to be, and you can see that there's a significant boost of funding for each phase. Last week, the Department of Energy issued the notice of intent that they're about to issue phase two, the funding opportunity announcement for phase two here. We expect to see that in March. So we'll be spending April and May writing that proposal. And hopefully we'll be one of the 8 that are selected to go forward. Frankly, the cost share requirements for phase two and three are going to be challenging for us to meet. And that's where we're really fortunate to have DGGS as fantastic partners in our CoreCM program. We're also working very closely with industry. I think that's where that match is going to come from. Aside from doing great work, with the DGGS, whatever they spend in support of furthering critical mineral opportunities in this state, then I'm in turn able to count those expenditures, their expenditures, as in-kind match for us. So continuing in a partnership with our state partners as we pursue phase two is going to be very important. And I'm really encouraged that this committee is providing some attention to seek a better understanding of the opportunity of rare earth elements in this state. So we're looking forward to working closer with the state agencies on some of this. DGGS has been just fantastic. Next slide, please. This gets into the tasks. I need to spend quite a bit of time on this slide. To realize DOE's vision to catalyze kind of regional economic growth and job creation, they've identified 6 objectives that, as I said, all 13 CoreCM centers must address. Phase one for all 13 centers is a planning grant. We're all expected to spend those funds to come up with plans to present to DOE about how we would proceed in phase two. So this table translates DOE's 6 objectives into the tasks that we are pursuing. Task one, I don't have on here because that's just project management. But DOE objective, which is our task two, is basinal assessments. So where are the critical minerals found within the region? DGGS is responsible for meeting this first DOE objective of ours. In April of 2023, DGGS published the Alaska Basinal Assessment of Carbon Ores, Rare Earth Elements, and Critical Minerals for Alaska. It was prepared as a deliverable under our contract for DOE, and it broadly summarizes our efforts so far. It's not as detailed as other DGGS mineral assessments, but it wasn't intended to be either. Instead, it reviews the data sources that are available to us. It describes some of the new data that is derived by looking at archive legacy samples found at the Geological Material Center, as I mentioned, and describes the different play types that one might expect to look for rare earths and critical minerals. SB118 would be great to enable DGGS to further its efforts under the CoreCM program too, thus providing you with the information you need while fulfilling a deliverable that we have for DOE. DOE objective number two, which is our task three, is waste stream reuse. This includes looking at critical mineral potential found in tailing piles. Indeed, one of our researchers is using artificial intelligence to go through the DEC database, for example, because their waste might just be somebody else's fortune. It might have some rare earth or critical minerals in it. We're also working with some other mines here in Alaska to look at their tailing piles and maybe work with them to address their milling circuits to pull some of those out before they hit the piles. I don't feel comfortable naming them publicly here, but we're very excited about the relationships we're developing. Additionally, rare earth elements are often not looked for. They're not really contemplated. So one of our jobs is to help the mines consider the potential for rare earth production in addition to their main products. In fact, just yesterday, no, it was Wednesday, we had a meeting with one mine and suggested that they look for such and such gallium, frankly, and they pulled out their ICP analysis and there it was. And they had never even thought about putting a value on it. And so they're pretty excited about that. So DOE objective number three, our task four, is strategies for infrastructure, industries, and businesses. So existing mines like the Isabella Coal Mine, the Red Dog Mine, Greens Creek Mine, and so forth, they've already invested in their infrastructure, and they're fully permitted for all phases of mining. So the incremental cost of producing critical minerals from those existing mines should be a lot more attractive than investing in new mine development project, because less new infrastructure will be needed in the existing mines. On the contrary, the new mine development will have to make new infrastructure investments. They'll have to navigate complex and numerous permitting issues. They'll have to ensure that they win the social license to move forward. So part of our project is to also help overcome some of the infrastructure challenges, which I might say includes energy. So DOE objective number four, our task five, concerns technology assessment, development, and field testing. This task has us assessing technology gaps across the full value chain for critical minerals for Alaska. It includes innovative and sustainable mining techniques for coal and other minerals, processes to separate and to purify critical minerals in-state instead of sending them out, technologies to incorporate coal-derived carbon, rare earth elements and critical minerals into value-added intermediate end-use projects, such as the renewable energy industry suggested in SB 118. And as part of this task, we're also looking into non-fuel uses of coal. In the interest of time, I won't go into details on some of those projects, although I'm pretty excited about them. I will point out that DOE is rather keen to promote alternative uses of coal. So DOE objective number five, our task six, it's entitled Technology Innovation Centers. During phase one, each of these CoreCM centers is required to formulate plans for a technology innovation center that will be developed and ultimately operated by public-private partnerships. And the Technology Innovation Centers will provide a platform to develop and validate the critical mineral, the CoreCM technologies at a laboratory scale, including technologies that utilize advanced manufacturing techniques. DOE is going to subsidize these centers initially, but the goal, as I said, is for them to become supported by the industry within their basin. So each technology innovation center is going to be aimed at overcoming the issues specific to the geological region that those basins are in. This is causing me to maybe take a sidestep here. One thing that I did not mention in discussing the 13 CoreCM centers is that our CoreCM center looks at all of Alaska. The other 12 centers around the country are tied to a specific basin. So, for example, North Dakota is looking at the Williston Basin. The University of Utah is looking at the Uinta Basin. Wyoming is looking at the Green River Basin. We're looking at the Alaska Basin. Of course, there is no Alaska Basin, but so we have a large regional approach to things, and that is more challenging for us in our in establishing our plans, like for infrastructure, technology innovation centers, and so on. So finally, the DOE objective number six, our task seven, is stakeholder outreach and education that's necessary to support the critical mineral economic development activities in the state. Plans will include development of technology transfer, get it out to the mines, education and training for technicians, for skilled workers, for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics professionals. Our stakeholder outreach efforts include collaborations with other R&D centers, the other core CM centers funded by DOE as well. So I'd like to move on to the next slide, please. So this graph illustrates all that's involved in the rare earth elements critical mineral value chain, whether it be for the renewable energy industry or any other industry, the steps are all the same. In Alaska, it makes sense that our default is to focus on the exploration and the mining part of the value chain, but a mine alone isn't of much use to a manufacturer of batteries, for example. Long before that rare earth element can be incorporated into a product like a battery, it has to undergo a series of steps, which are illustrated here. The more of these steps that we can perform in state, then obviously the higher the value of that element to our state. After the ore is mined, you'll want to concentrate the ore so that you're just shipping less material off the mine site that has no market value. Then that concentrated ore ends up at a facility where the rare earth elements are separated from the native ores. This process is usually done through acid leaching, which then would yield rare earth oxides or REOs on this chart. And then that REO is sent to a metal refinery and then finally incorporated into a product. As we all know, Alaska exports its ore for processing outside the state. So even if we start mining critical minerals, they still need to be separated into rare earth elements and then processed into a form that allows them to be incorporated into a product. Alaska is at a disadvantage to the Lower 48 because of our high energy costs and because of the logistical challenges that we face. If we overcome these, then there's no reason we can't become a mining and processing mecca of rare earth elements for our country too. I like to use the state of Utah as the example. They have a robust mining industry, processing industry, and tourism industry. It can all exist side by side. Next slide, please. So up to this point, I focused on our CoreCM program funded by the Department of Energy. But thanks to appropriations made to the university last year by this body, other parts of the university have also increased their work in pursuing critical minerals. So specifically in the Institute of Northern Engineering, the part I work in, we're using these funds to invest in an ICPMS. That is an instrument that allows folks, the industry, to take an ore sample and identify what the elements are there in a very specific manner. It's considered the only real acceptable data that DOE accepts. There are a couple of ICPMS units in Alaska, but they're not used at all for mining. In fact, they're often prohibited from it because of the contamination potential. And then increasingly, when folks like Usabelli Coal and others send out the samples for ICPMS analysis, companies won't work on it if it's got any carbon or coal associated with it. So this is going to be a huge asset for the state, and we're already expecting a lot of customers for that. It has many uses outside of the mining industry as well. So the Geophysical Institute's high lab, airborne cameras and spectrometers, they can provide an exceptionally detailed map of an area's geologic makeup by measuring the surface reflectivity in a variety of wavelengths. And then this can inform us about the mineral composition on the ground surface. And then you can investigate further if need be. And then similarly, the Geophysical Institute's Advanced Instrumentation Lab has many assets for use in determining the rare earth element composition of so many minerals. More importantly, that equipment in this lab can inform us how that element is bound to the ore, and that in turn helps us determine the best method for separating that element from the ore. The next slide, please, is my end. So thank you. I appreciate your attention and the opportunity to make this presentation to you.
Well, thank you very much, Director Sheets, for that information. We also have some invited testimony. So I'm going to open up invited testimony now. Deantha Skabinski is online. Deantha, can you hear us?
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, great. If you would give us your testimony, please.
I'd be happy to. Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Deantha Skabinski, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Miners Association. AMA is a membership association that represents all aspects of Alaska's mining industry, the large hard rock and coal mines, mining exploration and development projects, small family placer mines, industrial gravel and rock, and the vendors and contractors that support our industry and the mines across the state. We wish to express support for the intent of the bill, and we offer some suggestions for improvement. First, we wish to express our gratitude to the bill sponsor and to this committee, Madam Chairwoman, for prioritizing the conversations that highlight the critical and essential minerals on which our society is dependent. Unfortunately, the majority of these minerals are currently sourced from foreign nations with adversarial relationships and unacceptable environmental and social values, as the bill sponsor pointed out. This bill directs Alaska's government to assess the potential of sourcing many of these minerals here in our state and identify strategies that attract the investment we need to do so. I can tell you that passage of legislation with these kinds of directives sends a powerful message to the investors that the state of Alaska is a jurisdiction of choice in which to invest. We would suggest that to improve this bill, you would remove references to the global energy transition, as it describes an unrealistic pivot from fossil-fueled energy generation. And while the pursuit of renewable energies and the underlying increased need for mining and the minerals that it produces is needed to meet global energy demands, it's abundantly clear that relying on only renewable energy is not a reality for Alaska or the world. Solar panels and wind turbines are important supplements to our base energy needs, but even with battery storage technology, they cannot power a community for days or weeks. Only diverse sources of energy, including reliable and dispatchable fossil fuels, will bring affordable and dependable heat and power to Alaska's residents and businesses. So we suggest the word expansion could be instead be used to communicate the goals in discussion. Altogether, SB 118 outlines how Alaska's mining industry should play a role in helping provide the essential minerals that the world needs today to develop alternative energy technology. We all know that mining is done better here, where our regulatory requirements ensure worker safety and excellent environmental performance. Thank you so much to all members of the committee for hearing this bill today and taking this up, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. And I'm happy to answer any questions or provide additional information.
Thank you for your testimony, Deantha. I don't see any questions. Thank you. Next up, we have Karen Mathias, also for invited testimony. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Karen Mathias, and I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Metal Mines, formerly the Council of Alaska Producers. I appreciate this opportunity to testify in support of SB 118. You've already heard about the increased global demand for responsibly produced metals and minerals and our country's current dependence on those mineral imports is a risk to our national security, to the development and production of new energy technologies, and to the economy. Clearly, the U.S. needs more domestic mineral production, and Alaska, with its abundance of minerals and its rigorous regulatory process, should be part of that solution. So since you've already heard about all the many uses of critical minerals, I will focus my time on three key points from the perspective of Alaska's metal mines. First, there's a risk in exclusively focusing on the term critical minerals, simply because there are at least three different federal lists, the U.S. Geological Survey, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Energy. And those lists change from year to year, which doesn't really help with planning processes. So, for example, zinc was only recently added to the list. And another example is copper. It's not on the USGS list, but it is on the Department of Energy list. And the reason for that is that the Department of Defense looks at supply and risk right now, in today's time, whereas the Department of Energy looks out to 2035. And they focus on two things, both the supply demand for minerals that are important for energy, but also the risk to that supply. So there's widespread agreement that the amount of copper needed for clean energy technologies over the next decade greatly surpasses the expected supply. And while these lists help draw attention to the need to increase domestic mineral production, Alaska's focus really should be on the production of Alaska's minerals. As Mr. Sheets mentioned, we have one of the largest zinc mines in the world and tremendous copper resources here in Alaska. But we also produce gold and silver and have rich deposits of many other minerals. So that brings me to my second point. We only have a small number of mines, and we have, as you know, particular challenges due to our high energy costs and our lack of infrastructure that make it more difficult to turn our deposits into producing mines. We all know about the concept of industry clusters like Silicon Valley or the Biomed Research Triangle in North Carolina. And those clusters bring together companies and suppliers, R&D, and also workforce development in ways that support one another and are beneficial to all of the companies. And the fact is, Alaska needs a diverse mining industry in order for us to create that kind of mutual support. So gold may not be in short supply, but Alaska's gold mines are key to the health of the industry here because access to a large pool of skilled workers, to university research and vocational programs, and to the businesses that supply goods and services make it easier for new companies to invest in exploration and development of all types of minerals. My last point is that many of the listed critical minerals are not economically feasible to develop on their own. They're often produced as byproducts. Mr. Sheets mentioned Red Dog in northwestern Alaska, one of the top producers of zinc in the world. It's the exceptionally high grade of that deposit which made it possible to build a mine in such a remote area above the Arctic Circle. They also produce lead and silver and a small but very important amount of germanium, which is, as Mr. Sheets mentioned, on the USGS critical minerals list. It's used in the electronics and optical industries. So it's not actually feasible to have a germanium mine, but it's produced in Alaska thanks to a zinc mine. And this is true of many critical minerals, and just something to keep in mind. To conclude, SB 18 calls for the state to investigate strategies to encourage investment and increase exploration and production of critical and essential minerals. We think this is a worthy effort, and we appreciate the opportunity to testify today in support of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Mathias. Any questions for her? Seeing none, thank you. Online also, four questions from the committee are Sandra Moeller, Melanie Worden, and Melly Worden. So if there are any questions from committee members for those folks, seeing none. So at this point, I'm going to leave public testimony open. That was invited testimony. I'm going to leave public testimony open. Do you have any closing remarks, Senator Merrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. SB 118 is an effort to attract investment, create jobs, boost our economy, and keep America safe. So I appreciate the opportunity to present Senate Bill 118. Madam
Chair. Thank you, Senator Merrick. We're going to set this bill aside and take it up at a later time. So our next and final item on our agenda that will take the rest of the time is Executive Order 132, eliminating the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council. This is the first hearing of this executive order. There are five executive orders referred to this committee thus far. And so the committee will be hearing about them. We also have legal opinions that we've asked for. And the legal opinion that I've reviewed related to this particular executive order indicated no conflicts with the Constitution. So, invited to the table today is Mr. Ricky Geese. He is the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation in the Department of Natural Resources. Welcome, Mr. Geese.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here, Senator Geisel and members of the Senate Resource Committee. My name is Ricky Geese. I'm the director of the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. I'm here today to talk about Executive Order 132, the elimination of the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council, and on Monday I will be talking on the other executive order that impacts state parks with the Woodchick Management Council. So the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve is close to 44,000 acres of river bottom near Haines. It was established by the legislature in 1982, AS 4121611. The primary purpose is to protect and perpetuate bald eagle habitat inside the preserve, and it's one of the world's largest concentrations of bald eagles. The state constitution, Article 8, Section 7, special purpose sites, the legislature may reserve land from the public domain. The legislature closed the preserve to multiple use and dedicated the area as a special purpose site, which means it's closed to oil and gas leasing and mineral entry. Traditional uses such as hunting, fishing, trapping, and other subsistence and recreational uses are allowed. Those are compatible uses, and then it's interesting with state parks because we have to regulate and allow compatible uses through the regulatory process. So the advisory council members are 12-member advisory council established in AS 4121625. The governor appoints 3 members to 2-year terms: Haynesborough, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Upper Lynn Canal Fish and Game Advisory Committee member. The Haynesborough mayor recommends to the governor appointee to fill the seat representing commercial or industrial interests. And then there are ex officio members named in the position by statute: the Haynesborough mayor, Klukwan president, the Chilkat Indian Village council chair, the Chilkat Indian Association chair, the Haynesborough assembly member, fish and game commissioner or designee, the parks designee, and then the forestry designee. So currently right now of the governor's 4 appointments, 3 are vacant. And the ADFNG, so out of the 12, there are 4 vacancies currently right now. The advisory council responsibilities. The advisory council provides feedback, recommendations, local insight regarding management, operations, and facilities. The meetings serve as a forum for public input to park management. Members set agenda items and discuss topics such as user conflicts, resource issues, proposed developments, regulation changes. The council shall assist the department in monitoring and revising the preserve management plan. The last time the management plan was revised was in 2002. And for all our state parks across the state, an important thing to understand is that the Division of Mining, Land, and Water, the Resource Assessment and Development Section, RADS, like for other state lands, does all our management planning. So it's a robust public process for management plans for all our state parks that we follow. And that we do with our sister agency, and that's their kind of niche and specialty that we do an RSA with them. And that was the same process that was done for the development and the update of the original management plan and the updated amended plan in 2002. So things that the council can provide input on, it's reviews commercial use permits before the start of the upcoming operating season. We do that consistently throughout our park units. Review and comment on regulations impacting the preserve. Review and comment on any findings by the director that a traditional use is causing significant resource damage. Use information from cooperative resource studies to comment on management decisions. Review notice of proposed additions to or deletions from the preserve. The Division of Forestry must consult with the council administering the state the Haines State Forest Resource Area Management Plan. That is in the process of being updated right now. And Fish and Game must consult with the council on proposed regs governing fish and wildlife management in the Eagle Preserve. One clarification, especially important with Fish and Game, is that Fish and Game, through the Board of Fisheries and the Board of Game processes, sets all regulations in all state parks for management of fish and for wildlife. So. The DNRs, our division's role, we coordinate and support the Advisory Council by issuing public notices for meetings, assisting with agendas, taking minutes and or recording the meetings, especially having moved through COVID. Now, most of our regional citizen advisory boards that we have, in addition to the Management Council, the Advisory Council, and the Advisory Board on the Kenai River, we have 11 different regional boards across the state. We've gone to Teams meetings, and it allows people who are uncomfortable coming in person to participate through Teams, and we put those recordings of the meetings on our website. For the Advisory Council, we coordinate appointments through the Governor's Office, and the Governor's Office has 130 different plus boards and commissions that they operate with. And we also are filling requests for information from DNR. The council met online since 2020, and the most recent council meeting was in November 2022. The May 2023 meeting lacked a quorum. The advisory council, like our other regional advisory boards, have a set of bylaws which kind of coordinate how meetings and the procedures of the advisory council will meet.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Dunbar, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you mentioned on a prior slide that three of the four governor's appointments are vacant.
Correct.
Were any of those vacant in May of 2023?
I believe we've had an issue with those governor's appointments of not of continuing to have vacancies, and that's I can ask our superintendent on specifics of you.
Yeah, I'd love to hear.
Okay,
if there was the same vacancies in at that time.
Is that person online? Oh, he's present
right
in the
here. This is our superintendent, Preston Cruz, who is our Southeast Region superintendent. Just put yourself on.
Hi, my name is Preston Cruz. I'm the Southeast Superintendent for Alaska State Parks. Yes, to answer your question, all three vacancies.
Can I ask a follow-up, Madam
Chair?
Yes,
follow-up. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Had the governor's appointments, those three, been filled, would there have been a quorum at this May meeting?
I cannot say for sure because it would have been some of the other seats. I can't recall exactly what the turnout was, but it more likely it would have met the quorum.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'll let you continue.
All right. Thank you. So Executive Order 132, what it does is it sunsets the Advisory Council. Stakeholder input would be received through traditional channels and creation of a division, a regional citizen advisory group. We have eight of those throughout the state, and I'll talk about what those are in a little bit. We find that regional input from the public and the local community is vital to our operations of Alaska State Parks. We have parks in six different regions of the state, and we have in every region that we have the superintendents and key staff interact with the regional citizen advisory boards and advisory council and the management council and then the charisma one. So we have two appointed by governors, one appointed by the commissioner, and eight are regional citizen advisory boards appointed by the director. The why is to create efficiencies and establish a single point of contact for preserve management in critical areas. That key piece of contact is the superintendent of the region, and then we also have key staff, and then myself as the director, and our section chief, Wendy Sailors, as the, our community engagement officer. It eliminates duplication within state government and aligns management activities of those with other parks. So the model being followed then are the eight other regional citizen advisory boards. Future, the management processes don't change. Revisions to the management plans, once again, any revisions to any of our management plans go through DMLW, through the RADS section. And those involve multiple public meetings and everybody in the Haines area if there was a revision to the management plan would be invited and encouraged to participate. ADF&G remains involved in the management plan development and associated activities. So, future stakeholder engagement from our perspective in parks and DNR, we do have other important engagement tools. As I mentioned, the creation of a local citizen advisory board covering the, all the parks in the region. One of the issues of being prescribed in statute of just being the focus being the Chilkat Preserve, which is 44,000 acres, is that we also have about 20,000 acres in different park units in the Haines area that, because it's not the purpose in statute for that advisory council to give comment and feedback to us on, we don't get feedback and comment on these other park units. And those other park units, in addition to the Paul Legal Preserve, are Chilkat State Park, which is about a little less than 10,000 acre park south of Haines, the Chilkoot Lake State Recreation Site, which is to the east, Mosquito Lake State Recreation Site, the Portage Cove State Recreation Site, and then two undeveloped state marine parks, Chilkat Islands and Sullivan Island. So currently right now, instead of setting up a regional one for Haines that would be duplicative, we just don't have a means to have kind of robust public input on that. It's kind of ad hoc after our Chilkat, Chilkat meetings for the preserve. If there's any questions on other state park units, then it's kind of, okay, the meeting ends, and then we can kind of informally talk about it. But those aren't public notice. And, you know, for instance, we just had a design and construction project where we took the right-of-way, the DOT right-of-way, and we repaved that, the Chilkoot Lake State Recreation Site, and we put in a new bear viewing area. That was design and construction came down, had a robust set of meetings. I think there were four or five different public meetings in the area. But if we had a regional citizen advisory boards, we could have done that through that board process instead of having kind of a duplicative secondary process for design and construction to do. And in most other regions of the state, when design and construction has a project, an infrastructure project, for example, like at Chugach State Park, we go to the Chugach State Park Citizen Advisory Board, we public notice, hey, this is going to be on the agenda for this day, and invite public testimony on that. The way that we do citizen advisory boards is that we provide the same staff support that we do for the advisory council and the management council and the CRISMA board to the citizen advisory boards. We like to have multiples of three. We have three-year terms. And then kind of have rotating multiples of 6, 9, 12, 15, and then either you're appointing two people, three, four, or five people per year. And so it kind of gets into a rotation in the springtime or in the fall whenever they're asking the public notice for people to participate. It kind of gets into habit, hey, people in the community who are interested, please send in your applications. The regional advisory boards review those applications. They make recommendations with the input of the superintendent to the director. If there's no major red flag or anything, we just sign off on those, and it's kind of organic of the input from the citizen advisory board. Members can represent multiple user groups, and currently we have active wards in Chugach, Juneau, Ketchikan Bay, Ketchikan, Kodiak, Mat-Su, the northern region, which is the Fairbanks area, and Seward. And I know that in both the Management Council in Wood-Tikchik and at the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve, there are designated seats, and that's up to the region when we set up the bylaws. If they want to continue with designated seats, we can write those into the bylaws and, you know, have those designated seats continue on. So,
Senator Dunbar, you had a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think you partially answered it, Director, but I just wanted to sort of be a little more explicit about it. So an interesting feature of this advisory council is that there are three seats, Klukwan Inc., Chilkat Indian Village Council, and Chilkoot Indian Association, that are actually in statute and required. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, are there statutory requirements for that if you were to set up a board like you're describing? Are there any statutory requirements that those entities or other indigenous entities are included in that future council?
We do. So it's an informal process. Regional citizen advisory boards are an informal process, and we work through the bylaws of that community, creating their bylaws that work for their community. Currently, we don't have designated seats, but if Haynes wants to continue with the designated seats, we'll work with them and put them into the bylaws.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Kawasaki, question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the you mentioned that there's you started to mention the local citizen advisory boards. Are there currently local citizen advisory boards that overlay the specific Bald Eagle Preserve now?
No. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, no.
So it's, I guess, Madam Chair, so I guess it's not duplicative at this point, but it might be in case if there is going to be a local citizen advisory board appointed by you.
We would work with the local community, probably the existing advisory council would be kind of the initial set of members of it, and then we would write bylaws for a citizen advisory board, and then just continue on with appointments. One of the advantages of having director-appointed seats when there are vacancies is that it's kind of simpler and less steps for a citizen advisory board to, with the, you know, work with the DNR staff, which is our staff, basically, to make recommendations to the director, and the director review through it and then make a decision and make the appointments. And then so there's probably maybe a 1 week or a 2 week turnaround on recommendations that go through me that then have to go to the commissioner's office. You know, there could be up to a month or 2 month lag or kind of latency and when appointments get made. When they go to the governor's office with 130 different boards and commissions, we can get to a few months to many months in terms of vacancies, in terms of appointments. And so I think one of the benefits, you know, anytime there's change, it's tough, right? Because this isn't how we did it, this is how we do it. And anytime there's change, sometimes it's difficult to recognize what the benefits may be. And I think in this case, for the Bald Eagle Preserve, with the advisory council, if we set up a regional citizens advisory board, there's going to be all the parks in the area will have a public forum to get feedback for us in park management that I think is important. The time of the vacancies, I think, will decrease, and so we'll have less vacancies and more meetings that will have quorums to have the meetings. And we'll keep in place the same management plan process, which is through DMLW, the RADS section, And all our management plans have to go through a public process, and all of them, you know, eventually get signed off by the commissioner, the DNR commissioner. So that process stays the same.
So,
follow up
just on a couple earlier. I'm trying to figure out what we're changing and how we're changing the current makeup and the advisory council responsibilities. I think it's the slide 5. It talks about the council assisting the department in revising the plans, and I'm wondering how frequently that's happened, or basically how frequently it happens and whether it hasn't been happening under statute.
So the management plans for state parks, there was, you know, when the legislature in the 70s and 80s established the legislatively designated areas, kind of that initial SLU, all of them got set up as management plans. Then in the 90s and 2000s, a grouping of them had their management plans updated. Most recently, we had Chugach State Park was updated in the early 2010s. And then most recently was the Catchback Bay State Park and Wilderness State Park management plans were updated. The management plans tend to be around for 20, 30 years. And if there's, changes in the statutory language, like Wood-Tick-Chick State Park, a few years back, the legislature passed a statutory change where to Wood-Tick-Chick State Park, where the Nyakuk Falls hydro project was not an incompatible use to the park. We have not made changes in the regulation or management plan yet because we don't know if that project, that hydro project, is going to be certified through FERC. If it is certified, then the legislature likely will have to make adjustments to the boundary of Wood-Tick-Chick State Park.
Thank you.
Senator Kawasaki, or excuse me, Senator Wilkowski, you had a question?
Thank you. There was a lot of talk last year about potential carbon offset projects in Haines State Park. Do you know if there's still discussion of that happening?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I believe we have online DNR Law, Chris Orman, and we also have...
I can give you the list. You have Parker Patterson, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. You have Christopher Orman, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law, Natural Resources Section. And you have Joe Feckel, Legislative Liaison, Department of Fish and Game.
So I'll leave it to Chris or to Parker, whoever is most best suited to do the carbon offset discussion.
Christopher or Parker, which of you would like to respond?
Senator Geisel, this is Christopher Orme, and I think I can go ahead and answer that.
That would be great. Go ahead and identify yourself and answer the question.
Understood. This is Christopher Orme, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Law. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. So currently, we're in the process of drafting regulations for carbon offset projects on state lands pursuant to what's now in statute 3895-400 through 499. And so that's really kind of an update for you as far as, you know, the project and where we are as far as moving towards projects on state land. I know that's oblique, but I think that's the best update and response I can give you.
So,
any follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
No, but I do have a question for Mr. Geese.
Yes.
I know the administration supports local control. Is that fair to say?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. I believe the administration likes to have people involved in the public process at the local level involved with parks. We definitely do within our division, and our commissioner definitely supports that. And when I've spoken with the governor, he supports that also.
And I, if I could,
yes,
and I can imagine that if there was a federal law that said before you take an action in Alaska, you have to consult with Alaska. That if the Biden administration just said, you know what, it's more efficient to not do that, what would the response be from the administration? Would you support that? It was more efficient? You'd oppose? I know what your response would be, right?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'll let the governor's office speak. The administration, I do not
I
speak.
I think we all know what the response would be, not just from this governor, but probably from any governor out there, right, in the state of Alaska. And if I could follow up. And so what I'm seeing here is in Section 2, there are a series of requirements in Section 2. Division of Forestry and Fire Protection shall consult with the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council. Before enacting regulations from the Department of Fish and Game, they shall consult. The level and method of Section 4, the level and method or means of traditional use may continue subject to regional regulation unless the director of the Division of Parks of the department, after consultation with the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve. So is there a requirement to consult there? There's a requirement to consult in Section 5 on privately owned land, University of Alaska land, valid mining rights, existing mining rights are going to be, that regulations will affect that. In Section 6, there's a shall consult. It says the director of Division of Parks and Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Advisory Council, in written consultation with the United States Fish and Game Service, may use information gained in development of a management plan. So currently, under current law, there are all these requirements to mandatorily shall consult. That gives a lot of power. That gives a lot of authority to the local community. This takes that all away and says, well, Section 7 says, well, we'll have a management plan and it'll be presented at public hearing in Haines, period. That's it. You think that one little section makes up for all those requirements to shall consult and give that mandatory consultation ability? You think that one little section makes up for all that? Or would you agree that this is a diminishment in the community's ability to advise and be consulted?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the process that we do engagement with the public remains the same, and that's through DMLW, through the regional assessment and development section, through RADS. All our management plans follow the same basic process. So the current management plan follows that process and followed that process. Any amendments to the current management plan will follow the same process with or without the advisory council and statute being there. That's how we do management plans through the state. The management plans for Ketchmack Bay took, I think, 6 years. The management plan for Chugach State Park took about 10 years. And they involved many, many public meetings and many times where there's engagement and availability for the public for public comment, both in person in writing and in person through public meetings.
And if I could, and I don't want to belabor the point because I know we have witnesses who want to testify, but I'll just say the requirement in statute right now to consult is not the same as some management plan that you might put out there and have people come in and testify. I don't think there is any equivalence there at all. With all due respect, in my opinion, I just don't think there is. But we'll hear from the witnesses and see what they have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? And as soon as we're done with questions, we can get to the citizens. Yes, Senator Dunbar, a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for that reminder. It'll be a very quick question then, because I think it goes off of what Senator Wilkowski said, but I've worked with the Chugach Advisory, the other system, the Chugach Advisory Board, and I found them to be great. There is a lot of public participation, and so I do think that that system can work for some places, but it still doesn't sort of answer for me why you're doing this. And I can read the page where you say duplication and management activities, but with other parks, but it still doesn't quite make sense to me, Has this preserve been mismanaged, or do you have examples where this citizen advisory board has been ineffective in some way? I just don't understand what's wrong here that needs to be fixed. And I wonder if you could give examples you could give to us.
Senator Dunbar, through the chair, I'll just go back to the kind of basic upshots of what the positives potentially most likely will be that we find in other areas with citizen advisory boards. One is that all the state park units in the area will have a public forum where we can get feedback, which we currently don't have. We could do it, but then we'll be doubling up. We'll have a preserve meeting, and then we'll have a meeting for all the other stuff, and we'll, two different agendas. And we talk about efficiencies. It's like we can put that all on one agenda, one public notice for all the state parks in the Haines area. Second thing is, in my experience during the time I've been director, I can review and make appointments to the citizen advisory boards in a much quicker time frame than what the commissioner's office or going through the governor's office can do. So we'll have fewer vacancies on these regional boards, and we can have cover more topics, and we can have more meetings without fear of not making a quorum. And we can keep the same kind of management planning process, but for the different citizen advisory boards, when there are fish and game topics, we bring in the people from fish and game that are expert in that topic. When there is a DEC topic, if there's a contamination someplace and we want further explanation of it, as a sister agency, we make arrangements and have that person from DEC come in and talk on a specific issue. So there are many times in the different citizen advisory boards that we bring in sister agencies and get public feedback on an explanation and program presentations on a topic.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Director.
Further questions from committee members? Seeing none, thank you, Director Geese, for coming to the table. I want to get to the citizens now. I want to let citizens know that we have received a large number of letters. Oh, and I also want to recognize that Senator Jesse Keel and Representative Andy Story are in the room and have been for the entire hearing. But we have gotten a lot of letters concerned about this. Most recently, Upper Lynn Canal Fish and Game Advisory Committee, Central Council of Tlingit Haida Indian Tribes, Haines Borough, those just arrived today. And out of all of these, we've had one email that has supported the executive order. But I want to get to citizens now. I'm going to start in the room because I know you folks have traveled to be here. I'm going to start with David Strong. He's traveled from Clothwan today, pardon me. And then after that, we will go to Joe Nelson, who is here in the room also. So welcome, David. So the deal is I'll have you introduce yourself for the record, so your name, any possible affiliation. I do have 15 other people wishing to testify. So I'm going to give you 2 minutes, okay? And if you take less, that just makes room for another person. No pressure. All right, I'll let you go ahead.
My name is Man on Top of the Fort. My English legal name is David Albert Strong, Jr. I'm a councilman over at Chilkat Indian Village. Since I got 2 minutes, I'm going to cut some of what I was going to say. But first, I would like to say Joe Nelson here, he's my clan opposite. We do this for out of balance. We have protocols in our culture. This is what stewardship is to us, is our protocols, our way of life, Hakrustiye. And I would like to say Chilkat Indian Village is federally recognized tribe government with inherent sovereignty, and our tribal constitution requires us to protect our tribal lands and the interest of our tribal members. We are asking Alaska State Legislature to reject Executive Order 132 by passing a special concurrent resolution protecting the integrity of the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council. I'd like to also state that the reason I have asked my Akane, my clan opposite here, because Chilkat people, this advisory board, Chilkat, is Chilkat. It's not a Tlingit word, it's an Iyak word. Our people, the Gonoktedi, when we formed Klakon, there was 4 groups of our migration. And one of them was Shakayik Adi, that came from Copper River, from the place of Yakutat, Shakayik. And these people, when they settled, they came from the place of Chilkat at Copper River originally. And they're the ones who named the area over at Klakon, that river there, Chilkat. The Klahini, Dog Salmon River. All these places have a name for us because we know what we use them for. And for stewardship for us, we think of the Yakohegu, the land, the spirits that are on all things. When we consider this, we consider what are the things that can happen by decisions that will cause Jinaha. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Joe Nelson, next. Welcome.
Chair Giesel, Senators, Gunath Cheesh, Joe Nelson, live right down the road. I'm here on behalf of Sea Alaska Corporation, the Native Corporation for all of Southeast. And I'm going to be challenged to top my partner here, but he's a raven and I'm an eagle from Yakutat. And there's a reason why all of our communities and the indigenous people have been here so long. And it's because of the place. It's not about a bald eagle. It's about the people of the place on how it's been thousands and thousands of years. I guess I'm here on behalf of our entity that owns, you know, the land, but we're all tribal people. And I received a call from the tribe when this was moving. So that's why I showed up. And there's just so much common sense. And I'm all about efficiency and alignment. But if that efficiency and alignment doesn't start with the knowledge that's there, been there for thousands of years, then it's got to start over, and it's got to come back to the place. And so I appreciate the lines of questions from the senators to understand what kind of movement is afoot here. If there is movement and something comes out of this, the ask would be that the local tribe, the original locals, actually chair these advisory committees. And actually are the ones stewarding the place. And it's just common sense, I guess. So I appreciate the lines of questioning that we're coming together here and really encourage the body here to go ahead and reject or put on hold these executive orders and go ahead and own the legislation and the people and the citizens and listen to the citizens. So I really appreciate it. All the input that's coming in, the original folks of the land, the voice, you're going to hear it along the way here. So, Gunath Cheesh.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll go offline or on out of this room and to the online. We'll start with former Representative Bill Thomas. Ms. Representative Thomas, welcome. I will allow you 2 minutes.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. Chairperson and members of the Resources Committee. Like I said, I am Bill Thomas and live in Hayes, 76 years, commercial fisherman, and I've been involved in politics since 1976, starting in Washington, D.C. You can hear my dog in the background. He don't like what's going on. But I've been a lobbyist, and I know most of the members of the committee. I was chairman and CEO of Klakwinik when we started the act of the creation of the Bald Eagle Preserve. And we did that because environmental community, the Audubon Society, dropped the bomb on us through Senator Gary Hart to go and create a potential boundary change from Glacier Bay National Park over to, into Haines to include the Haines Klakwinik. And in that bill, they all had authorization for condemnation rights, which we totally opposed because, as Lonnie Strong, who spoke for us, told him what next for the residents of Klakwan, Oklahoma. And I had a chance to speak, but I yield to Byron Malott from Sea Alaska, so I'm glad that Joe Nelson is there. And I want to reiterate strongly that Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve is not a park. If you look at the bill, it's a preserve. It's not a park. And I was listening to the testimony. They keep talking park. It's not a park, and we've had that fight for years. Regulations passed to involve parks do not involve the preserve. It was a very contentious bill. We had an organization, Haines that got together and all the citizens working. And the governor at the time, I think, I believe it was Jay Hammond, sent chipped in a line. And Reed Stoops up here as planners to develop the bill that we ended up with. I'm just totally against what's going on. I believe the strong need for citizen action is imperative. We have, you know, they may not listen to us, but we still want to have the input. And so I, like I said, I spent a lot of my time. I lost a lot of friends when we created the Bald Eagle Preserve. And we'd like to see it left alone and grow up. Merrill Palmer. It's interesting. Now, Merrill Palmer was an Alaskan miner.
Representative Thomas.
Developing this bill.
Representative Thomas. Sure. Representative Thomas, your 2 minutes is up. If you could wrap up, please.
Well, okay. I'm just totally opposed to it. And I think the control needs to be, they need to involve the village here and the people in Haines, both. So I strongly feel the advisory committee is working and is as visualized by the drafters of the bill. Thank you, Senator Giesel, members of the Resource Committee.
Thank you, Representative Thomas. The next person up online is Mark Soji, Vice Chair of the Upper Lynn Canal Fish Advisory Committee in Haines. After him will be Joe Sonnen, or Sonnen, in Douglas. So welcome, Mark. You have 2 minutes. Please introduce yourself and for the record.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, loud and clear.
Yeah. My name is Mark Soggy. As stated, I'm from Haines. I'm a fisheries biologist, retired as manager of the Lynn Canal Commercial Fisheries for Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I serve currently as the vice chair of the Upper Lynn Canal Fish and Game Advisory Committee, which represents the communities of Haines, Clackamas, and Skagway. I'm speaking for the advisory committee today. We believe that EO 132 is not in the state's best interest and will significantly impact important local fish and wildlife resources. We voted unanimously to request the legislature to pass a resolution to overturn EO 132. The legislature designated the Eagle Preserve Advisory Council to work with DNR to develop the management plan for the preserve and make decisions affecting the management and administration of the preserve. Preserve is not a park, as Bill Thomas just stated, and should not be managed as one. It was created for the specific purpose to, and I quote, protect and perpetuate the Chilkat bald eagles and their essential habitat within the preserves. It would be a mistake to lump the preserve in with the management of other parks. Council members have valuable information to contribute to the preserve decision-making process. EO 132 would eliminate our ability to directly take part in this as a in this process as an equal player. The council is composed of representatives of entities with legal and or vested interest in the preserve that DNR does not represent. The preserve's subsistence and economic resources are essential to the people of Haines and Clackamas. We deserve to be at the table when the state agencies consider important decisions regarding these resources. The legislature established the preserve council to preclude the conflicts that divided Haines for many years prior to the passage of the preserve statutes. The council provides a crucial way for preserve-related issues to be worked out between user groups. Solving local problems locally provides for efficient, transparent, and responsive governance. In summary, the council provides the preserve managers with the expertise and guidance needed for decisions about fish, wildlife, eagles, water quality, subsistence, and other areas mandated explicitly for protection of the preserve. The council ensures representation of vested and legal interests. The council provides the venue for resolution of local conflict. If EO 132 goes into effect, this essential community voice would be lost. Please retain the preserve AC through a concurrent resolution overturning EO 132. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Soggy. Next, we're talking to John Sonnen. He's in Douglas. After him will be Kimberly Strong in Clackamas. John, welcome.
Howdy. John Sonnen here over on across the pond in Douglas. Howdy. Thanks for taking my testimony, committee and chair. And thank you, Senator Wolkowski and Kawasaki, for your opposition to this executive order. It's this executive trend in our state right now, but more importantly, coming from the nation after the last administration that we got to put a halt to. It's appalling. It's against any sensible drive towards justice for all, which is what the nation is built on. We got to oppose the grab of power by the likes of our governor and by stopping his executive order on the Baldwin Preserve here in Haines, and also Haines on the Las Colinas Highway. This is just appalling, and it's going to present a sense of misery around the entire populace. We continue to let this trend carry forward. We got to get back to democracy. It's the only way to true justice for all. Synergy is all of us work together, we make more. But when we're all working apart, like the mindset of this current GOP, I think, we're just going to be trying to duplicate. More efficient is duplication. All it is duplicating and wasting energy. We've got to conserve, become more efficient with our energy use. If we ever want to stop the destruction of our home planet, is what it is. It's our only planet.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sonnen. Your 2 minutes has expired. Thank you. Next up is Kimberly Strong, president of the Chilkat Indian Village, and following her will be Kip Kermoinen. Kimberly, welcome.
Thank you very much, Senator, Chair, and the senators of the Resource Committee. I appreciate this opportunity. We did send in a letter of testimony on behalf of the tribe, but I just wanted to touch on a couple of things that I meant we neglected, or I neglected in the letter. And that is, I think Senator Willikowski did an excellent job on that. We were talking about local control, and when we were developing and participating in the creation of the Bald Eagle Preserve and its advisory council, it was interesting times, and we were going to Washington, D.C., opposing the federal regulations for various reasons. But one of the big reasons for going with the state is that the advisory council was going to be a local council. And as Senator Rosowski pointed out, if the federal government came in and told us how we were going to run things in Alaska, there's a big pushback by everybody for that. But when state government comes in and says, we're going to take your advisory group away because it's easier to do it from Juneau. It's easier to appoint people that are like-minded of us and how we want to run things, as opposed to what is mandated and is put into this regulation. And I appreciate Senator Willikowski saying the things that he said about the components of it shall, that gives the power to this group that other places may not. And if anything, if they want to put some of the state parks into the advisory council, maybe they should come back and suggest that instead of just taking away the advisory council. And again, we encourage you to pass the joint resolution to overturn Executive Order 132. Goodness sheesh.
Thank you, Kimberly, for your testimony. Next up is Kim Kermoinen in Haines, and he will be followed by Shannon Donahue. Welcome, Kip.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kip Kermoinen. I'm a resident of Haines, and I'm speaking today to encourage you, Senators, to override EO 132. As a resident of Haines, I've been engaged in subsistence activities, hunted, recreated, worked within the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve for more than 40 years. I've also held the Upper Lynn Canal Fish and Game Preserve, Advisory Committee seat on the Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council for a number of years. And during my tenure in that seat and as a public participant, it is clear that the Preserve AC has provided a functioning, community-based, democratic forum where numerous local issues, public and agency concerns associated with the users and the management of the more than 49,000 acres can be voiced, discussed, debated, and understood, often resulting in the Preserve AC making recommendations that have broad community support. The governor's contention that eliminating this 40-year transparent tradition, which was thoughtfully designed to accomplish exactly what it has successfully done all these years, to be replaced by a State Department whose primary purpose under this administration appears to be prioritizing the permitting of extractive activities at the expense of habitat fragmentation and potential toxic degradation to that habitat and to the remarkable wealth of species that it supports, and in so doing, putting at risk existing traditional subsistence activities by Indigenous and other community members who have relied upon these remarkable resources for centuries. The potential impacts to the many existing commercial activities associated with the health of the preserve, such as fishing and tourism, could also be at risk should EO 132 not be overridden. To disregard the years of public voluntary dedication, longevity, value, and success of the Preserve AC is inexplicable.
Kip, your time has ended. If you'd wrap up, please.
I will end there. I thank you all for your time and your insight questioning the purpose of this. It's quite clear what it is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kip. Next up is Shannon Donahue. She'll be followed by the mayor of Haynesboro, Thomas Morfitt. Shannon, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Shannon Donahue. I live in Haynes and I'm testifying on behalf of Rivers Without Borders. Thank you for being here. I'm thinking for the health of most of the Chilkat River just downstream of the Eagle Preserve. I'm asking you to overturn the governor's executive order that eliminates the Bald Eagle Preserve. I value the improvement I received there and the opportunity to engage with management concerns. The increase is important to our local communities for our fisheries, tourism, recreation, cultural, and subsistence activities. The preserve supports numerous local businesses and the borderless economy. Beyond the benefits of the preserve itself,
Shannon, you have cut out. We did get the gist of your message, however, and thank you for that. We'll go on to the Haynesboro Mayor, Thomas Morfitt, next. Mayor, welcome. And following him will be Katie Palmer. Welcome, Mayor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Haynesboro strongly opposes Governor Dunleavy's order to abolish the Preserve Advisory Council. The council isn't broken. Don't fix it. We feel, to a certain extent, that we're being hornswoggled here. I'm dubious of these regional citizen advisory board being an improvement over a situation that has worked here for 40 years. This advisory council works because it's local and it's collaborative. Includes lay people and government officials meeting, talking, and voting together. In Haynes, we battle over many issues, but we don't battle about the Eagle Preserve because the Eagle Preserve Advisory Council does a good job of airing issues and resolving them in an agreeable way. The council relies on science and local expertise to make its decision, and that system works. Managing for the diversity of uses in the preserve, and I'll repeat an important point, the preserve isn't a park. It allows subsistence fishing and hunting, commercial fishing and hunting, guided hunting, firewood cutting, cruise ship shore excursions, all within the state's only wildlife preserve. It's Alaska's only wildlife preserve, and it's a special creation, and it deserves to have its own advisory board, which has worked. As to whether these other parks aren't being represented, I believe there's language in state law that allows for a separate advisory council in Haynes for those other four park units. But a larger concern we have is that this administration has underfunded, closed, or abandoned state parks in Haynes in the past 3 or 4 years. We don't have a park ranger. We haven't had one for 4 years. Roads aren't being maintained, trails aren't cleared, picnic tables are rotting. Some of our state parks would be national parks if they were located in the lower 48, but they're suffering chronic neglect. So this is kind of just the latest of many concerns we have about the administration's management of our parks here, the beautiful parks, and we feel they're getting a short shift here. And I urge you to turn over EO 132. The council is one part of our government that has worked wonderfully. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mayor. I want to address the committee now. I have five more people to testify, so with your indulgence, we'll go over time tonight. Next up is Katie Palmer in Haines. She'll be followed by Eric Holly, also in Haines. Katie, welcome. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Hi, thank you very much. My name's Katie Palmer. I'm calling on behalf of myself in Haines. And the testimony so far has been wonderful. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate the comments by Senator Wilikowski about the legalities of this, how many requirements there already are in statute in the original legislation that say the AC will be consulted with before X, Y, and Z happen. And I also appreciate another senator, I'm sorry if I didn't get his name, but asking why is this happening? There is in the Y section of the little DNR picture, saying what, why, and future. This is not increasing efficiency. It's not eliminating duplication. And it does not align management activities in the preserve with those of other parks. As it's been stated numerous times, the preserve is not a park. It is a unique unit all by itself, the first one ever, the only one within DPOR that has its own regulations. It is not a park. I will stop there. I intend to send an email letter in, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Katie, and you bring up a good point. Anyone wishing to add testimony can certainly write in to us. So next up is Eric Holly, and he'll be followed by Peter Gall. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Eric Holly. I'm representing myself today. For 35 years, I've been either the president or vice president of Lynn Canal Conservation. In Haines, we played a key role in establishing the preserve about four decades ago. I have also occupied the conservation seat on the council as a substitute for appointed conservation seats in the past. EO 132 under the Y section says it will make government more efficient. It doesn't make government more efficient by discarding a perfectly functional advisory council that's uniquely suited to advising government regarding specific management of this eagle preserve, that probably the only eagle preserve in the world, as far as I know. And also under that section of the Y of Executive Order 132, it says it establishes a single point of contact. Well, as many people have said, why would you do that when there's this broad spectrum of citizens and agencies representing decades of local expertise, and in the case of the tribal entities, centuries of local expertise and knowledge. As many have said, the justification of aligning management with other parks makes no sense. This area is unique. It's not a park. It is a preserve, and it is unique in the nation. So none of the reasons that justify Executive Order 132 make any sense. I'm not going to have time to read this, but in the 2002 Chilkat Bald Eagle Plan, Chapter 1, Page 8.
Eric, your time is up, so if you could summarize, please.
Okay, just please read the history and legal environment from the Chilkat Bald Eagle Plan and put forth a concurrent order that maintains the existing advisory council. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Next up is Peter Gall. He'll be followed by Jessica Plachta. Peter?
Thank you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, please proceed.
Great. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. This is Peter Gall. I served as State Representative for Haines. And greetings to the members of the committee and to all of you. I'll speak to that in a moment. I served as State Representative from Haines from 1983 to 1991. And prior to that, was consulted during the development of the Haines State Forest and Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve legislation by Governor Hammond and Senator Ray, and then for 8 years in the House, worked with Governor Sheffield and Commissioner Warnke on the development of the first management plan, and then followed the implementation for 8 years as a citizen afterwards. I think the deletion of the preserve advisory board is extremely, excuse me, I'm so sorry. I believe the deletion of the Preserve Advisory Council is very problematic, but I'd like to pause and just kind of share, you can hear my excitement. If this were back in 1978, what you folks would be dealing with were dozens of angry, screaming people who were threatening your staff, threatening members of the administration when they would come to town, create public meetings that literally cost hundreds of thousands of dollars over a period of a couple of years, disrupted the Upper Lynn Canal communities that remained divided for almost a decade. It was a horror story. And the parties got together in a history that I can answer if you question me, and put together a collective plan to address the issue. The state government was involved. It's true, Gary Hart in the U.S. Senate was involved, certainly Governor Hammond, and the fishing communities in Haines and the tribes. They all worked together for a period of years, and out of it came a resolution which by some kind of miracle worked. And what you're seeing here today, are instead of the horror of a Haines public meeting, and ask anyone who was there, here are a group of people from the Upper Lynn Canal agreeing.
Mr. Gall?
To work together. Yes.
Mr. Gall, your 2 minutes is up. If you'd please summarize.
Minutes are up.
Please summarize.
2 minutes. I would say 3 sentences, if you'll permit me, ma'am.
Please proceed.
Number one, this law has worked. Number two, if you disenfranchise the native people of the area, which you will be doing, if you take away their only formal voice in day-to-day management, the state is going to face a controversy that is not appropriate at this time. And number three, this is going to cost the state money and not ease management. This is an independent body. It is not part of DNR. This is not a reorganization. This exceeds the governor's authority. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Gall. Next up is Jessica Plachta. She'll be followed by Kathleen Menke. Jessica, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, honorable members of the Senate. My name is Jessica Plachta, and I'm the executive director of Lynn Canal Conservation, a 50-year-old nonprofit based in Haines. On behalf of our hundreds of members and the entire community, we request that the Senate and House pass a concurrent resolution overturning EO 132 and keep the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve Advisory Council for the essential services it provides. The Preserve AC ensures a fully informed state agency and is crucial for the responsible management of the preserve. LCC was a signing founder of the Alaska Chilkat Bald Eagle Preserve and has monitored its success over the decades. The legislature established the preserve during a challenging time in the Chilkat Valley, but it has grown to be a universally appreciated and a significant economic driver. EO 132 is not in anyone's best interests, and it will diminish, not enhance, its essential values. This community depends on the preserve's resources, including fish and wildlife, commercial activity, recreation and tourism, and subsistence foods. We're especially concerned that the indigenous seats on the preserve AC are currently the only formal place for the original stewards of this land to have a voice in its management. The Preserve Advisory Council is nothing less than the community's voice on the lands and waters at the heart of the Chilkat Valley. Members of the Advisory Council include various local entities with local knowledge and perspectives.
There is no substitute for local and traditional knowledge. Please retain the Advisory Council by overturning EO 132. Incidentally, I applied and interviewed for the vacant conservation seat several years ago, and I continue to wait for the governor's response. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for your testimony, Jessica. Next up is Kathleen Menke. Kathleen, you are our last testifier today. You're batting cleanup. Welcome. Please give us your testimony. Are you there, Kathleen? You might be on mute because we're not hearing you. All right. Well, we're unable to hear you, Kathleen. However, you can email us your testimony. We would welcome that. Thank you for signing up to testify. So that concludes our meeting today. The next meeting will be Monday, February 5th at 3:30 p.m. On the agenda Monday, we will hear a presentation from Santos, who is developing the PICA project up north, and their net zero approach. We're also going to have the first hearing on three executive orders. The first one is Executive Order 124, prohibiting the regulation, live capture, possession, transport, or release of native exotic game or eggs. Also, the first hearing on Executive 126, eliminating the Wood-Tikchik State Park Management Council. And lastly, Executive Order 134, eliminating the Recreational Rivers Advisory Board. At this time, this meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 5:11 p.m.